This podcast was recorded at the 2016 JADPRO Live at App Show Conference in Washington, D.C. The title of this session is Understanding the Mechanism of Action for Chimeric Antigen Receptor, or CAR, Therapy, and it is presented by Edward Stadtmauer and Patricia A. Mangan, Abramson Cancer Center, University of Pennsylvania. To view the presentation material or see other topics of interest, please visit advancedpractitioner.com/sessions2016. To claim continuing educational credit for these activities, visit education.annenberg.net/JPL16-sessions. And now, we're delighted to bring you this podcast from JADPRO Live.
So our next session, I'm very excited about this, friends and colleagues here to speak, and it's entitled Understanding the Mechanism of Action for Chimeric Antigen Receptor, or CAR, T Therapy. Please join me in welcoming Ms. Patricia Mangan of Abramson Cancer Center and Dr. Edward Stadtmauer of the University of Pennsylvania.
It's really our pleasure to be here today to talk to you about CAR therapies. What a beautiful hotel this is. Let's see. So disclosures, both Trish and I have worked as consultants for various industry advisory boards. In terms of the learning objectives, we're going to describe the mechanisms of action of the CAR T cells and how they differ from other forms of cancer medicine, discuss the logistics of autologous T-cell therapy, including apheresis, processing, replacement infusion. We're going to review the steps needed to address the major treatment risks associated with CAR T-cells, especially that cytokine release syndrome. And we're going to show how we monitor patients' response to treatment and manage signs and provide long-term support for care who receive these therapies. So the rationale for this cellular immunotherapy, and I'm going to emphasize B-cell cancers, but we actually have these chimeric antigen receptors or engineered T-cell therapies, studies going on for brain tumors, for breast cancer, for pancreatic cancer, for mesothelioma. So, you know, those are a little less advanced in development, but this really is potentially a therapy for all of oncology. But the rationale really started with the obvious fact that, unfortunately, despite all of the chemotherapy, radiation therapy, surgery that we have for various diseases, that advanced and relapsed and refractory disease still has a poor prognosis and survival is limited. T and NK cells, so these immune cells from B-cell cancer patients, can kill autologous cancer cells in the laboratory. So, you know, we've done experiments where we activate T cells and we can see the cancer cells be destroyed. And then, of course, for decades, we've been doing allogeneic stem cell transplant, which is in many ways just the infusion of a donor's T cells into a patient. And we've obviously seen these responses and cures when we infuse these donor T cells by causing a graft versus tumor effect, a graft versus leukemia effect, a graft versus lymphoma effect. But of course, there's high morbidity and mortality usually associated with the graft versus host disease. So the philosophy is, if perhaps we could engineer our own immune cells so they could specifically attack a tumor, we could get a good graft versus tumor effect, but since they're your own cells, that you wouldn't have the graft versus host disease that leads to so much of the problems. So targeted cellular immunotherapy could overcome the limitations of conventional chemotherapy and immunotherapy. And there, the advantages of autologous T cells that are genetically modified is they can be sort of a super antibody therapy and with the cellular component of an amplify response and lead to memory cells that the cells just stay in the patient's body to keep eating up any potential tumor that comes back. The first thing you have to do when you make a cellular therapy or an immunotherapy is figure out what target you're going to use. And it's really important to determine what is the best target, because you want a target that is uniquely on the tumor cell and not on other parts of our body. You know, these cells can sometimes be so active and so aggressive that if by chance the heart has the target on it, and the same target as the tumor, then these cells are going to attack the tumor but also attack the heart. And so you have to be very choice in your decision of what to direct these cells against. And CD19 has been the original or the first target that we've directed a lot of these cells to, because CD19 marks primarily lymphocytes, and lymphocytes at all levels of development. And since that's why you'll see that most of the original cancers that have been treated are the cancers that are CD19 positive or B cell malignancies. And you can see on this chart that the earliest B cells are CD19 positive, those are the cells that lead to acute lymphocytic leukemia. Then as they mature, which leads to the chronic lymphocytic leukemia and the lymphomas, they still are CD19 positive. Once they get to be plasma cells, the most mature B cells, they tend to start losing CD19. So what are the ways that we've tried to overcome sort of immune suppression and immune tolerance to cancers? You all know of the monoclonal antibodies that we've, rituximab being really the first major one, and most recently in myeloma, we have two new ones, that elotuzumab and the daratumumab. Chemotherapy and immunomodulatory agents are actually somewhat immunostimulatory, particularly the lenalidomide and the pomalidomide, et cetera. You're going to hear, as I'm sure you're hearing every day, and you'll hear a little bit more from Tricia, is the checkpoint inhibitors and how they are stimulating the immune system. But what I'm going to emphasize today are the cellular therapies and the what we call the tumor-infiltrating lymphocytes, the CAR T cells, which are the chimeric antigen receptor engineered cells, and the T cell receptor engineered T cells. There are three major approaches that are shown on this diagram, and they all are basically the same thing. The first thing you have to do is you have to collect lymphocytes from the patient, and with the CAR cells and the TCR cells, it's mainly from the blood. We do leukapheresis to obtain these cells. But also, you can go to the tumor itself, and in the case of a hematologic malignancy, it's the bone marrow. So the guys, particularly here in Maryland, at Johns Hopkins, have done a lot of work with marrow infiltrating lymphocytes. So the lymphocytes that are around the lymphoma cells or the myeloma cells are the cells that are most likely to be directed against the tumor. So if you do a bone marrow aspirate, get those cells, you can then cook them up and activate them and potentially use them. I'm not going to speak much more about that. But the other two is to actually take the blood T cells, and again, you engineer them to put on their surface a receptor that will basically be a warhead to find the tumor cells, and then you, outside the body, expand them and activate them, and then give them as a blood transfusion. You hear a lot about chimeric antigen receptor, and so here's what, in a diagrammatic form, what they are. a chimeric antigen receptor has three different parts. One part is outside the cell, and it's an antigen recognition part. So it's like an antibody receptor. It has a light chain, it has a heavy chain, and that's what's directed against CD19, for instance, or BCMA, or whatever it is you want to direct. Then there's a part that goes through the cell membrane, and then inside the cell are these what we call stimulatory and co-stimulatory molecules. One of them is called 4-1BB, another one's called CD28, another one's called CD3-zeta, and what these are molecules or that are inside the cell that when the receptor gets attached to something, sends a signal into the cell for the cell to start proliferating and get activated. So it's really cool. And so what they did was they made genes, genetic material, DNA and RNA, that code for these receptors. And then the first thing that you had to do was create a receptor like this, get the DNA. The next step is you have to insert this DNA into your T cell. And the vehicle that we've used to do that is a lentiviral vector. So we infect these cells with a virus, a lentivirus. And then it does what viruses do, which is to insert genetic material into the T cell. And then, so getting a lentiviral vector, making the DNA, and then finally you have to have an artificial T cell stimulating tissue, and that was we call it an artificial dendritic cell, which is a magnetic bead that has on its surface two antibodies, an anti-CD3 and an anti-CD28 antibody, which makes the T cells, when they are incubated with these cells, think that there's an infection going on and makes them proliferate and get activated. So it was these three molecular biology techniques, creating DNA to code for the chimeric antigen receptor, making a viral vector that infects these cells, and then having a technique to cook them up that is really took 20 years in many ways. It seems like this is just, the last couple of years this has happened. It really is 20 years of work to do this. In fact, my son is a senior in college, and he's an evolutionary biology major. And when he took molecular biology, the first lecture in his course was about the chimeric antigen receptors and to try to motivate them and show them how the stuff you're learning might actually really be useful sometime in the future. So this just in a cartoon, once again, to show. So remember, you take this chimeric antigen receptor and you put it into a virus, you infect the cell with the virus, and then the cell then becomes a machine to put on its surface these chimeric antigen receptors, and then they find the tumor cells and induce apoptosis and cell death. Now, every time you hear about these cellular therapies, basically, this is the diagram of how they're used. You take a patient. It has to be an appropriate patient, a patient with a disease that is not clearly easily treated with the current therapies, but is well enough to undergo this procedure. And the first thing you do is you do a steady state T cell leukapheresis. So you take out the T cells. And then outside the body, those T cells are incubated with the magnetic bead laden artificial dendritic cells. They're cooked up. They're infected with the cells, and you make a batch of these cells. And you can actually make numerous batches. So the product can be infused in whatever batches that you need. Meanwhile, the patient usually gets some sort of therapy to suppress their immune system to allow the donor, these T cells to engraft. We call it lymphodepleting therapy. And then it's just a transfusion, a quick transfusion of these cells. So CD19-directed chimeric antigen receptor T cells for B-cell malignancies have now been widely published. Ever since, I think 2011 was the first publication of three patients with chronic lymphocytic leukemia. And actually, the only reason why it was only three patients that were presented was because the money ran out. It was very hard to actually get grant funding for this sort of thing because it was so sort of science fiction-y and so much in the future. But when all three of those patients responded beautifully to therapy, and I think two of them remain long-term alive, like one of those patients is 6 years out, complete remission, doing well, that then stimulated the whole system. But it was only since 2011 that the first reports came out. So now there's 27, probably that's old news. Throughout the world, there are many of these things going on. And just to give you a summary, in chronic lymphocytic leukemia, about 50% of the patients, these are relapsed, refractory patients, have no other options. About 50% of the patients respond nicely, and about half of them, or 25% of the total group, are long-term doing well. The real miracle is in acute lymphocytic leukemia, where somewhere in the neighborhood of about 90% of the patients who've received these cells, all relapsed, refractory, no other options, respond, and maybe two-thirds of those people are long-term doing well. And though I said greater than 3 years, we now have patients who have durable, complete remissions 5 years, 6 years out. And this just shows you the survival curve. This is from the New England Journal in 2014, where, again, about two-thirds of the patients, most of these were kids, and, in fact, probably pediatric B-cell ALL will become the first indication that might be FDA-approved, but also adults having very nice responses. In fact, the famous patient is Emily Whitehead. She was actually the first pediatric patient that was treated, horribly relapsed, refractory leukemia, got really sick in a way that Trish will discuss, but miraculously got through it and is in a continued complete remission now 5 years after that therapy. So ALL, CLL, probably what you don't know as much about, so I'll give a little bit extra on it, is non-Hodgkin's lymphoma. Obviously, non-Hodgkin's lymphoma is one of the more common diseases in B-cell hematologic malignancies. And so since 2014, we've been doing a study relapsed and refractory diffuse large cell lymphoma, follicular lymphoma, or mantle cell lymphoma. And these patients, just like in the same diagram that I showed you, get their T cells harvested, get some lymphodepleting chemotherapy, and then get infusion of the cells. And we wanted to see how well this would work in this CD19 positive disease. And the choice of lymphodepleting chemotherapy is really the physician's choice. We try to direct that to what is logical for the particular disease. For instance, in non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, sometimes that hyper-CVAD type Cytoxan is reasonable. For myeloma, a slug of Cytoxan. For ALL, it might be high-dose Ara-C, but we give some sort of lymphodepleting therapy and then infuse the cells. And so here, this is a report of the first report given by Steve Schuster, who's the lymphoma specialist at our center who did this study. 43 patients with a combination of follicular and diffuse large cell. And so just looking at the large cell lymphoma, this is 26 patients. And they had an average of about three prior lines of therapy. About a third of them had a prior stem cell transplant. And you can see that the lymphodepleting therapy that they got was a whole concoction of different things. Some people got that EPOC regimen. Some of them got Cytoxan. Some of them got infusion of etoposide. And in the end, about 50% of those patients responded to this infusion of therapy. And what's most important is that after about 6 months, no patient has relapsed from that. The median follow-up is only a year and a half so far, at least from this report. But these are durable. That's the key to this whole thing, that is durable responses with these infusions. And this is, you know, a picture's worth a thousand words. You can see the PET scan lighting up in the pelvis and completely going away. And look at that, just literally 1 month, 4 weeks from the infusion of these cells, the PET scan normalizes. How about follicular lymphoma? Follicular lymphoma, you know, is a more chronic and indolent disease. We have a lot of therapies for it, but but once it goes bad, it can be really bad. These patients had an average of 5 prior lines of therapy. Many of them had a transplant. And so this was a heavily pre-treated group of patients. 77% of these patients, 80% of these patients respond just to the infusion of these cells. And more impressively, again, that in this case, unfortunately, there was a one late relapse at about a year, but virtually after, again, 5 months, virtually every patient remains in remission who hadn't relapsed within 5 months. So again, durable remissions, I think, among similar, sort of rivaling the ALL responses that we've seen. And again, a picture, you can see that this is a PET scan that was lighting up all over the place, and literally a month after the infusion of these cells, a completely normal PET scan. What about myeloma? So myeloma, there's as I sort of suggested to you, that CD19 may not be the most logical target. And we know from that daratumumab medicine, CD38, it seems like a really nice target. And then the elotuzumab has that CS1 SLAMF7 as a target. But maybe CD19 isn't so insane. So let me show you. As I showed you, the plasma cells don't generally have CD20 on their surface. I mean, CD19 on their surface. But we had a hypothesis that, you know, to make a myeloma cell, you have to first be a lymphocyte, and lymphocytes are CD19 positive. And so perhaps the mother cell is CD19 positive, even though the progeny aren't. So CD19 positive sort of stem cells. Additionally, there was evidence that there is a back and forth to cells, that plasma cells can de-evolve into CD19 positive, maybe even chemotherapy resistant clones, and that there's a back and forth. So maybe focusing on CD19 maybe won't kill every myeloma cell, but it might kill the mothers and it might kill the most resistant cells. So we designed a study that would at least give us some suggestion as to whether this hypothesis is correct. What we did was we took patients with multiple myeloma who had very bad prognosis. They had a stem cell transplant, an autologous stem cell transplant, but had less than a year of progression-free survival. So we knew that transplant was not the answer for them. And then we let them have whatever therapies they were going to have after that. And then if there was ever a time we thought it was reasonable to do a salvage transplant, another stem cell transplant, which we commonly do in multiple myeloma, we would then do that, but follow it with an infusion of these anti-CD19 stem cells. And then if you have a remission, traditionally the second remission after a stem cell transplant is shorter than the first remission. So if we had remission inversions where the remission lasted longer in this salvage stem cell transplant, then that would suggest that these cells are doing something useful. So it was just a 10-patient pilot study, what we did before. We took some T cells out. In this case, though, the patients got a stem cell transplant, and then we infused the engineered T cells. And the bottom line was there was no significant toxicity attributed to these cellular therapies. We did have one episode of what Trish is going to talk about, cytokine release syndrome. But in general, and also, we didn't know whether it was feasible to collect T cells from a patients with myeloma. They're so heavily pretreated. Can you still get good, healthy T cells? But it was very feasible. And this is our famous patient that we published in the New England Journal of Medicine, who was the first patient on this clinical trial. She was 48. She had an IgA kappa myeloma, and she only had about 6 months of remission after her first stem cell transplant. And if you look at that curve, looking at her IgA level, she never went into complete remission after a stem cell transplant, and in fact, never went into complete remission before getting any of this treatment at all. She had had 10 prior lines of therapy over 5 years, and was basically dying of multiple myeloma. And she had all the treatments that you would expect. And most importantly, her plasma cells did not have CD19 on them. To the best of our ability, we could not. So it's not a direct CD19 effect. And then as you can see from the next curve, that we sort of kept her in a little bit of a remission by giving her doses of Cytoxan. And then we gave her a big slug of high-dose melphalan. And you can see we gave 140 milligrams per meter squared, which is less than the amount of melphalan that she had the other time. And then we squirt in this cellular therapy, and she went into a complete remission. And that complete remission was MRD negative. We did every test we could to see whether there was any evidence of myeloma still in her. And, this is the infusion of the cells with the whole team. And anyway, so, and what you can see, this is the graph that we published in the New England Journal of Medicine, that she went into complete molecular remission, and it lasted, and 15 months later, she was still in complete remission. So definitely a remission inversion. Interestingly, the T cells, as far as we could tell, all these engineered T cells did go away by about 3 months. And she did recover some of her B-cell function. But this just shows that we did a bone marrow biopsy that was packed with myeloma beforehand. It was completely empty of myeloma after the treatment. And this is 6 months after her treatment, against medical advice, skiing in Vail. I still can't believe she did that. Anyway, so really cool. We actually treated 10 patients, and 3 of those patients had these remission inversions, but 7 of them didn't, had shorter remissions, didn't get a lot of toxicity. So the logical thing is maybe we can now, why don't we get a different target on the myeloma cells themselves? And BCMA, it's called the B-cell maturation antigen, is on all of the plasma cells, but not on the younger myeloma cells. And so we've created a CAR against BCMA, and this is the study that we've been doing. It's not completed. We've treated about 12 patients, and the patients, again, get leukapheresis, and then they get infusion of the CARs. We give it in a number of different boluses over 3 days. So let me just show you again patient number one. We've been very lucky with patient number one, so... So treat the first patient very nicely, and they treat you nicely. So this guy was 66 years old, actually a cell biologist, believe it or not. And his diagnosis was a decade ago with myeloma. He had 11 prior therapies, was progressing, really full, packed with myeloma. His myeloma cells did express BCMA, And then he got just an infusion of these cells, and just like the other patient, went right into a beautiful remission. Within 4 weeks, no evidence of disease. He did have some cytokine release syndrome, but otherwise did well. A bone marrow biopsy, day 28, negative. after being packed before that. And he's now about, we're seeing him in 2 weeks for his 1 year follow-up completely in remission. So very cool. The NIH has been doing this BCMA-directed cellular therapy. And just like us, they see very similar results. It's only about, again, a third of the patients having these wonderful responses, but seems very reproducible. To conclude my portion of this talk, I think that we're seeing really successful cellular immunotherapy. It's immunotherapy for myeloma and lymphoid diseases started with sort of the immunomodulatory agents, lenalidomide, pomalidomide, and of course those monoclonal antibodies that synergize with this. We'll hear a little, and checkpoint inhibitors have the potential of stimulating this. But there are many promising targets, many promising ways of making these cellular therapies. We've proven that you can get functional cells and that are active against these lymphoid diseases.
What I wanted to address, you know, after these exciting results, and clearly this is very novel and new, it is not without toxicity. And it's important to be aware of the potential toxicities. When the cells are infused, there's no significant infusion-related toxicity. Just to give you a sense, for those of you that may have participated in some of the trials, but for those that haven't, the amount of infused cells, it's very similar to a peripheral blood stem cell, but it is very purified in very small amounts. 10 cc's is what's infused. It's brought by, it's frozen after all that processing occurs in the lab, brought to the patient's bedside at the time of the infusion, defrost it, and just 10 cc's is administered. It can be administered over just one infusion, depending on the protocol. As you saw in some of the protocols, it's actually split up over 3 days, where a small amount is given day one, second day a little higher percent of the cells, and by day three, the remaining amount of CAR cells are infused. So it is a biologic and therapy. So it does sometimes have some fever, some chill associated with it. And so it's not a zero, it's not uncommon to see a little fever with that. Tumor lysis syndrome, just through the description of the patients that we saw, they were very heavily treated, high tumor burden. So it is a potential risk of tumor lysis. So we're always observing for tumor lysis labs, hydration, utilizing uric acid lowering medications and things like that. So there are toxicities, as Dr. Stadtmeier mentioned. We do utilize lymphodepleting therapy. And why do we do that? So we give, depending on the disease, we try to clear out some space in the marrow to allow these T cells to grow and multiply. And so that's why we give lymphodepleting chemotherapy. And in the myeloma trial that we highlighted with our patient who was skiing on the top of the mountain in Vail, she underwent a high-dose stem cell transplant. So we are dealing with the toxicities related to high-dose therapy, too, in that setting. So there are some issues, some cytopenias that we're dealing with at the time of the infusion. B-cell aplasia. We're targeting B cells. And these T cells, really, it's non-discriminatory. It kills B cells. So there is potentially a very profound B cell aplasia, and it's something to be aware of and monitor over time. We evaluate IVIG levels and administer IVIG, usually in a monthly-like fashion, and we monitor that to prevent recurrent infections. And up to now, we haven't really seen too many issues with infection related to the aplasia created by this. Cytokine release syndrome, though, that is the more serious and more common toxicity related to this. And so I will now highlight that a little more specifically because it is somewhat specific to CAR therapy, unlike other things that we have seen. It mimics very similar to a septic event where we see very high fever shooting up, some hypotension, and some hypoxia. These patients, sometimes these infusions that the T cells are actually administered as an outpatient. Sometimes we administer them as inpatient. We are very closely monitoring them, and if they are home, they are monitoring their temperature very closely, calling us immediately if they have fever. If we're concerned with a fever, very commonly in that divided dosing of the cells, day one, day two, we'll see a little mild fever, but it's associated now with a little hypotension. We might admit that person just to observe them for the evolution of cytokine release syndrome. Just to give you a sense, when is the peak activity that we see the cytokine release? It's usually around day 10 after the infusion of cells, although it can happen any time after the infusion and even later than day 10. But if you kind of look at all the patients that have been treated, the most common time of the real cytokine release is around day 10. It is associated, it's cytokines, and in particular interleukin 6. It is really stimulating this this release syndrome. It is similar to that H macrophage activating syndrome, which is usually seen in pediatrics. So we as adult practitioners weren't that familiar with it, but we're learning it's very similar to that, where there's a cytokine release happening. And it is associated with a very high ferritin level. So we monitor ferritin, just to give you a sense. A normal ferritin is around 300. And these can drive up very quickly to, right, it's listed here, greater than 50,000 or higher than that even. There is also C-reactive protein, as we know, is a surrogate marker for interleukin-6. And so that can definitely be elevated as well. So we do watch that cytokine release, C-reactive protein. The test that we do measure, though, is the non-cardiac C-reactive protein, because sometimes you'll check one and it looks okay and the other one's elevated. So just to give you a sense, that's the one that we're looking at. There is a mental status change that occurs, and that is it's very vague. And it's not a classic thing. Sometimes patients, it could be associated, or is it just because they're having high fever and they're sick? But sometimes they're a little confused. We had some people that had, like, word-finding problems, like I am right now. and some, it's really they become attunded. But we had one patient who was from Italy, and he spoke English perfectly. But when he became changed in mental status, he only spoke in Italian. And then as he got better, guess what? He started speaking English again. So it could be you start speaking different languages, but that's not true. So we know what turns this process off. Steroids. What do steroids do? They decrease inflammation, and they kill lymphocytes. So that's great. We have that. But we don't want to kill the T cells, right? We want them to proliferate and grow. So miraculously, we have found the antidote, really. Over time, we figured it out. And it's tozumab, or TOSI. And it is an anti-interleukin-6 monoclonal antibody. And we have really pulled people out of a very serious illness with the use of this. And so the interesting thing with this, in our experience, is that the patients who have experienced cytokine release syndrome tend to respond. There have been few patients that developed cytokine release but did not respond. And we've had some people that responded without cytokine release, but generally cytokine release is commonly seen, and it may herald the event of response. And so when do we give tocilizumab? We have gotten very good at doing this, and over time you'll figure it out. It is not very quickly given. It is a very serious discussion, usually in the middle of the night with all the primer PIs and everything. Should we turn it off now and things like that? And so these are the things that we are aware of. And as you can see in our results, we've given TOSI as soon as day two, and as late as day 11, commonly, or even a little later at this point. Again, let me just give you a sense of this. This is in hours. So we're looking at day zero is on the far left of your screen. And then you see the temperature curve was normal then. The patient developed some fever, but it was the temperature did go as high as 103. Tosi was given, and you can see how dramatically that just chilled out that reaction. Temperature resolved very quickly. And again, the ferritin levels, this is a different patient, but just to give you a sense, normal ferritin, and it's always important to get a baseline. Everyone, it's not really the absolute number of the ferritin. It's within that patient, the change that occurs. So some people are starting with a higher ferritin level than someone else. And so you can see this was a relatively normal ferritin level, jumps up with this whole cytokine release, and given Tosi, it dramatically improves. Graphics are impressive when you see this. So we know that it really, CAR therapy does hold great promise for patients with CD19. How best to engineer these cells, Dr. Stadtmer led to, there's just been an evolution of how best to keep these cells persisting in the cell, in the body, how best to deliver them, how best to manage this toxicity we're still working on, and certainly how, when to time the turning off of this cytokine release if it occurs, and how to maintain this persistence. But when you maintain persistence, which hopefully in many cases keeps people in remission, we're going to always deal with B-cell aplasia as a component of that. And so administering IVIG is always helpful. And then, of course, just to summarize, we talk about the toxicities of the cytokine release syndrome, the tumor lysis, and neurotoxicity, again, seen in many of the trials, this mental status, vague kind of thing that can vary. And usually it is self-limiting and does resolve over time. And we talked about the B-cell aplasia. Now, that is very cell patient-specific T-cell immunotherapy. So, and it's expensive and it's time consuming and you have to grow these cells up and things like that. So what are out there? Wouldn't it be great if we had T cells that that could activate T cells within a patient? We didn't have to take them out first. We could just pull some medicine off a shelf and give it to you. And this is what these bispecific T cell engagers are. And it's kind of cool where these are very small molecules and they're called BiTEs. And if you look at the center of this diagram, there is a piece of the BiTE that attaches to the T cell, CD3, on the surface of a T cell and engages there. And it activates the T cell. And the other component of the BiTE is attaching to a cell surface, tumor surface protein. In blinatumomab, the target is CD19. And so it latches on to that CD19 and causes a more activated T cell to attach to this and promotes more cell death or apoptosis. So these are really cool molecules right now. Just to give you a sense, blinatumomab is been FDA approved for B cell ALL, that is pH negative, I should say. And so it's been on the market for about a year now. So it does have some potential toxicities. And if you look at these, it's very similar to cytokine release and other symptoms that we've had with our CAR infusions as well. Flu-like symptoms, some tremors, some electrolyte abnormalities. The immunoglobulins do become suppressed. There are mental status changes with this. And just recently, I was walking out of work the other day, and that's when I checked my mailbox, because it's where I get on the elevator. And there was a handout I just received that there was a new warning of pancreatitis associated with this. And it was, so that's something too. We're always monitoring electrolytes as well. Blinatumomab, for those who haven't given it, it is an infusion over a month. And it's titrated. People get admitted to the hospital for that first week. And it's slowly titrated up It's very interesting. If you have to stop the infusion for any of these potential toxicity, it has a very short lifespan, very short life half-life. And so it very quickly resolves. But there is, unlike CAR therapy, where we don't want to kill those activated cells that we cooked up, we can turn this off also with steroids. And so this is a kind of the antidote for this, although tocilizumab can also be administered as well. But generally, just the stopping of the infusion. And then after 4 hours, if the infusion hasn't restarted, you have to go back to first stage again and then slowly escalate up again. So just to give you a sense a little bit about these bites, and maybe there'll be other targets in the future. And so it's definitely a cellular therapy. I know there was a big talk on checkpoint inhibitors again, that basically we know that T cells have evolved over time. Really, they're a part of our immune system to help us fight infection, and we know that they're very active and very good at fighting infection. But to self-preserve ourselves, T cells have actually created inhibitors or breaks on their own cells so that we don't attack our own body too much. And so these are programmed death PD-1, or programmed death antigen on a T cell. Has cancer cells also have a PD-1 ligand, and when they connect together, it prevents the T cell from actively killing it as a protective mechanism. So let's put a break on that. Let's inhibit that interaction with a breakpoint inhibitor, a checkpoint inhibitor, and it allows the T cell to be more anti-cancer against that particular T cell. We know that that particular cancer. We know that it's FDA indicated some of these PD-1 inhibitors tremendously efficacious in melanoma and lung cancer. And so we're now looking at it in blood cancers as well. And Nanolab was approved, and we know it's approved in Hodgkin's disease, I guess is the first blood cancer that it's been approved in. But we are looking at it even as a mechanism of action in other blood cancers. And we have a trial. There's been a couple trials, and I know in the audience that I have some of my myeloma friends here today, that there's combining pembrolizumab along with pomalidomide and dexamethasone has been shown some really exciting, and so it's more of a cellular stimulating our own T cells to be anti-cancer with some nice responses. So I know we're running out of time here, so I wanted to just end with that really the age of immunotherapy for blood cancer really is upon us. As Dr. Stadtmeier said, it's probably been upon us for about 10 years, but we just have been becoming aware of it recently. And so it's just, you know, the sky's the limit so much. And so how best do we utilize this technology? Do we move it up sooner in the disease state, earlier patients being treated with these long response rates? If we can move that up further, that would be tremendous. How best to make these T cells stay in the system longer for that persistence, and working on that and making them more potent, making more targets that we can treat many different cancers with this. And clearly, like with every other therapy in cancer, combining it with other agents. So, and as you can see, hopefully we gave you some of the thought process of this whole thing, and going forward, maybe some newer cocktails to keep people with blood cancers in particular, but all cancer, doing well for a long time and maybe cured. We couldn't do this without our whole team. And listed here are just some of our patients, of course, and our staff, our laboratory research guys have really worked very well. But just to give you a sense of that. And then finally, once this questions is in, this is a please go towards your, I guess there's a question, post questions that you can answer. So hopefully that was helpful, and I'll now open it up to any questions that you may have, and I'll ask Ed to come up and see if he drops his mic. So.
I have a couple of questions. One is, the patients that receive infusion, did you guys do it in outpatient setting or inpatient setting? And the next question that I have is the TOSI, because you say you guys did not treat the neural toxicity you guys saw, or very few of them. So the question is whether the TOSI was given as a drip or boluses.
Yeah, so our style and our plan is to always give these infusions as an outpatient. We as of this moment, since every patient we've given an infusion of has been on a clinical trial, we do it in our outpatient clinical research unit. And with monitoring, but usually I would say the most common time that they get infusion is around 11 o'clock in the morning, and usually by 3 or 4 o'clock in the afternoon they've left. We do ask that the patients, you know, we have patients coming from distant areas, and we do ask that they stay in the Philadelphia area for 4 weeks. So that we can, and we watch them at least for the first week, we watch them pretty much daily, but then afterwards we see them at least once a week for 4 weeks. In terms of the TOSI is given as a bolus. We just give a single bolus. We watch them. Our art, as Trish was mentioning, the art of this is to, since we don't know, we haven't done a randomized trial of giving TOSI versus no TOSI. We don't think it has a negative effect on the effectiveness of these cells. But since we don't know, we try to wait until this is the art of this. We wait until just before they might need to go to the intensive care unit for more monitoring. But we've avoided that circumstance in the vast majority of patients.
Thank you very much. It was a great presentation. I have two questions. I'm over here.
Oh, hi.
So the first one is, what is the time interval for monitoring the CAR T levels? And then can you talk a little bit about the survival of the CAR T cells and its correlation with survival?
Sure. It depends on the disease, it seems like, right now. So in those original studies of the acute lymphocytic leukemia and I guess in particular, we do monitor every month, and then it turns into every 3 months. We monitor levels of the CAR T cells in the patients, both by blood draws, as well as, because there's a genetic change, we can actually monitor by like PCR the genes. And so we monitor the levels of that. And so for our patients with chronic lymphocytic, our long-term patients, virtually all of them still have some of the detection at very low levels. And we do think that the levels of these cells will respond to the disease burden, that if they start relapsing, the cells will go up, then hopefully zap the tumor, and then they go back down. But not everyone. So there are some. So in like our myeloma experiments, the patients within a month, or within 3 months, their levels go down to nothing. And yet we have long-term. So I guess it depends on the disease. So in some patients, hopefully this zap kills everything and cures the disease. For others, they may need more of a serial thing.
Are you taking patients to transplant after they get the CAR T cells, or do you just get the CAR T cells and then you just watch?
No, that's a really good question. There are differences, but there are many centers throughout the country that are doing this work. And I think that different centers have different philosophies. And so a number of the centers have used CARs as a bridge to allogeneic transplant and with success. For us, we've been primarily focused on trying to use it as the cure. And so we haven't generally done automatically allogeneic transplants. We've had some patients who've relapsed after the CARs who've had transplants, or patients with ALL who just, like adults who had really difficult times who we've done that, but it's the minority of our patients and not of our plan to do allogeneic transplants.
This concludes this podcast from the 2016 JADPRO Live at APSHO Conference. To view the presentation material or see other topics of interest, please visit advancedpractitioner.com/sessions2016. To claim continuing educational credit for these activities, visit education.annenberg.net/JPL16-sessions.